moment," said Marble. "This Rome trip may not be the right time," said Benford, lighting another cigarette. "We do not want to wait too long, but I would like to wait long enough to observe whether there is a nibble from my little test." "Will you tell me?" said Marble. "I briefed that the American mole was stricken with shingles. It's what you said Igorov told Nasaryenko." "Poor Nasaryenko." "May I ask who you fed the bird seed to?" asked Marble. 15 members of the SSCI, officials at the Pentagon, a few staffers in the White House," said Benford. "Small enough group that we can check if we get a sonar return on the canary trap."
"Vizyago Dobrogo, my friend," said Marble. "Good luck to you. I will keep an eye open and signal in the event poor Nasaryenko jumps out a window."
"Very helpful," said Benford. "And if you could keep your eyes open for any other clues."
"I have something in mind, but later," said Marble.
Nate and Dominika sat together in his room and talked quietly. He acted nonchalant, but she knew better. She could see the intensity of his aura. He repeated that he had been worried about her. They all had been waiting for some word, and they all had been relieved when General Korchnoi reported that she was safe. He blamed himself for what had happened, her recall to Moscow. But now they could restart the relationship. They would work together again. Dominika thought he sounded like a case officer handling an agent, which was exactly what he was. He had been worried, then relieved.
Che tot zadivio.
Wonderful. Nate heard himself prattling on. He was conscious of the men in the adjoining room, conscious of the awkwardness of the moment. He knew he had to maintain control. He stumbled and stopped talking when he saw her face. She was elegant, stunning, poised. He remembered that expression, the set of her mouth. She was becoming angry. The endless months spent apart, not knowing if she was dead, and in the first hour together, he was pissing her off. Now what? She thought. They had been separated, and she had built up expectations, but things, apparently, would be different. They could not return to the heady days of Helsinki with her sneaking out of Volontov's residentura with pilfered documents under her sweater. The long afternoons in the little sun-splashed safe house, cooking on the little stove, were past. So was the little moonlit bedroom. She was a silly fantaserka, a woolly-headed dreamer. All right, she could be all business, and she wasn't about to make it easy for him. Dominika brutally told Nate about her recall to Moscow, about the cellars of Lefortovo, the endless days of questions, and the slaps and the purple lips, and how the cabinets at the ends of the corridors had creaked when she was shoved inside them. His face was ashen when she told him she had kept his image in her mind, and it helped her survive, bringing him along with her at her side, down the corridors and into the next room. Nate did not react, but she saw it in his eyes. The purple haze behind him was intense with emotion. Rattled, he got up from his chair. He was pouring wine at a sideboard across the room, and Dominika got up and went over to him. His hand was shaking as he filled the glasses. He wouldn't look at her. He knew that if in that moment they touched, he would be lost. Nate turned to face her. He looked at her hair, her lips, the 50-fathom blue of her eyes. His eyes told her, no, we mustn't. But his throat closed up, and his guts ached, and he took her face in his hands and kissed her, remembering the taste of her. They kissed each other madly, as if someone were coming to pull them apart. Dominika clutched his neck, and she walked him backward out onto the little marble balcony in the dying light. Doves were darting between the tips of the cypresses, black against the sky. There was no sound and not a breath of wind. She pushed him against the balcony railing, and wordlessly they fumbled with his belt buckle and hitched up her dress, and Dominika was on her toes facing him like a 5-minute tart in an alley off Kapoveski Peralok. She gripped the wrought iron with white knuckles, lifted one leg, and hooked her shoe on the railing. She mashed her mouth over his and moaned into his throat down to his belly. Her body shivered, and she let go of the railing and wrapped her arms around his neck to hold on.
All the bucking and shuddering and shaking on the little balcony made the doves in the trees jumpy, and they dipped and turned and flared among the cypress tops. Clinging to each other was sweet and natural and logical, and the little balcony became Dominica's entire world, and Nate became the only thing in it as he trailed his lips across her mouth. His arms tightened around her waist and her legs began to convulse. She whispered "Dashenka" in his ear, and the doves swooped in the night sky. They didn't move for 2 minutes. Then Dominica breathed raggedly through his kiss and pulled away from his embrace, smoothing her skirt. He tucked in a trailing tail of his shirt. They went back inside. Nate turned on a lamp and handed her a glass of wine. They sat beside each other, looking straight ahead, not speaking. Dominica's legs trembled, and she could feel her heartbeat in her head. It seemed that Nate was about to say something, but Benford entered the room just then to fetch them for dinner. Sergei Maturin, the SVR's executioner from Line F, sat at a small sidewalk table at Harry's bar at the top of the Veneto. He had a view of the front entrance of Igorova's hotel and was waiting to catch a glimpse of her, of Korchnoi, but especially of the figure of the young American. His squirrel-jumpy brain had committed the American's face to memory before leaving Moscow. There should have been some activity by now, he thought. His chest felt heavy and his mouth was dry. He was tempted to break into Igorova's hotel room, to wait in the dark in a corner, enveloped in his own vinegar-ammonia body odor. But he had been given strict instructions directly by Chief Zhuganov. Absolutely secret. No unnecessary action. Wait for an opportunity. Make no mistakes. Maturin was content to sit and wait. He eyed several young women walking up the escalator from the underground Borghese gallery, but ignored them in favor of his latest daydream of the group of Afghan women and children cowering behind the mud and rock walls of a hilltop sheep pen during the Parwan offensive. As the grenades from the GP-25s floated in lazy arcs and bracketed them, the women's screams mingled with the soft crumps of the explosions until they were silent. A raucous horn from a passing car on the Veneto shook him out of his reverie, and Maturin was sorry for that. Fori Imperiali Spaghetti alla Botarga. Sauté garlic and olive oil until golden, then remove garlic. Stir in butter and a spoonful of grated botarga roe, but do not overcook as it will become bitter. Add al dente pasta to the oil and toss to coat. Remove from heat, add additional butter and a second spoonful of botarga. Finish with fresh chopped parsley. Chapter 33. Resident Anatoly Golov would have been unsettled to learn how much the Orion team had divined about him personally from studying his street craft. This was a maestro, they said, an intellectual, an artist. He didn't use the ponderous SVR rules of street craft, the punishing high-speed surveillance detection routes, the arrogant demeanor, the offensive provocations at the end of a run. Golov's style reflected his many years as an operations officer in Europe and in America. His routes caressed surveillance, made peace with it, and only after hours of gentle manipulation did he break their hearts. But the Orions had identified patterns, preferences, predilections in Golov's SDRs. He was unaware of his stylish predictability, that he telegraphed his favored maneuvers. One of these was to execute a fishhook reverse in his route about three-quarters of the way through a normally straight and benign SDR. It was a murderously effective maneuver. He would simply disappear. Golov's fishhook confounded the G's, who for months had been jammed in his right rear quarter. The frustrated teams were ready to give him a spanking soon by boxing his car and taking him around the beltway three times before letting him take an exit. The Orions, observing from the wings, were more patient. They quietly studied Golov's maneuver. They wanted to understand it, quantify it, to confirm what they all began to realize. After he dematerialized, the shank of the fish hook was Golov's true compass course. It pointed to the final destination and his agent, as directly as the leading edge of the Big Dipper points to Polaris. It was the math, really. Golov would have been safe if he ran only the normal 5 SDRs a year. But the Russian spooks in the Washington Residentura were being starved out. They had work, contacts, sources to meet. Golov most of all. He had the enormousness of cusseting Swan, and he needed to be black for meetings with her. That required 2 or 3 SDRs a week. Like the aging movie star who takes any work she can get, Golov's SDR tricks were becoming overexposed. Sitting around a big table at a suburban Maryland Sizzler, members of the Orions enjoyed the early bird dinner special before the start of the evening. It was a small team that night, only 5 of them, but it made no difference. They were all old rock stars. Orest Yavorsky had emplaced polystyrene tree stumps packed with electronics in the snow of the Fulda Gap to listen for the midnight rumble of Soviet armor. Mel Filippo had led her blinded agent out of Brasov by the hand. Cleo Bavasotto had played Chopin for Tito while her husband cracked the safe upstairs. Johnny Parment recruited a Viet Cong general in Hanoi under the noses of a 20-person surveillance team. And sitting at the end of the table was the philosopher, goateed Socrates Burbank, nearly 80, thrice married and thrice divorced, the Buddha who invented trapdoor surveillance and who, from the back seat, called the shots and directed the team. Burbank had waltzed with the pig. He had done it all. In his early 20s, he had exfiltrated an agent and his family out of Budapest past idling tanks in Martyrs Square. He had hammered landing beacons into the doomed beaches at the Bay of Pigs. He had sat in an overheated safe house in Berlin, coaxing the intel out of a Soviet general officer stupid with vodka, holding the vomit can between the Russian's knees. Not even Benford interfered when Burbank was running the Orions, grease pencils between his fingers, laminated street maps on his knees, Toulouse-Lautrec holding a radio, softly talking to the amoeba. An afternoon of towering thunderheads in the west that evening culminated in a stupendous line of storms and lightning strikes that paralyzed metropolitan Washington. Tree limbs littered the flooded roads. The beltway became an unmoving annulus, and both airports suspended operations. It was the worst night for an SDR. It was the best night for one. Golov used the traffic to screen himself as he crawled from the embassy south through Georgetown, across the river on the Key Bridge, and south along the Potomac, stopping variously in Crystal City Underground and Old Town Alexandria. Stops in the equatorial downpour were more than uncomfortable. By the time Golov finished desultory shopping in Alexandria, he was soaked. So, too, was the FBI team that followed moodily in his wake. Despite the weather, Golov was trying to sell Mount Vernon as his ultimate destination, supported by a mild and linear route in that direction. Evening concerts and colonial dinners were popular at the mansion, and no surveillance team worth its salt would fail to flood the area if a rabbit even hinted at heading that way. The FBI did exactly that, sending 2 cars ahead and keeping 4 trailing cars way back on the resident. It was time for Golov's magic. His move would be covered by the traffic, the FBI too far behind. His fishhook was a quick turn onto the ramp to the Wilson Bridge, across the Potomac, into Maryland and Oxon Hill, through Forest Heights, and toward Anacostia. A puff of smoke and he was gone. 30 minutes later, the FBI team glumly radioed that they had lost the rabbit somehow on GW Parkway South. Mount Vernon was negative, and they were retracing the route, sweeping back through Alexandria and north into suburban Virginia. Golov's fishhook was stuck firmly in their mouths, pulling them farther and farther away. The rain stopped and traffic thinned as Golov cut north through southwest Washington, stair-stepping, doubling back, parking at the curb to wait and watch. The wipers streaked his windshield in the intermittent mode. He now had only to traverse the National Mall to enter downtown. He would park his car in an underground garage in the K Street corridor and walk the dozen or so blocks to the Tabard Inn. He had seen no whisper of trailing surveillance. His years of experience told him he was black, alone, free. Sock Burbank's grease pencil squeaked on the map. The reverse had been on the Wilson Bridge, the only explanation, and the shank was pointing downtown. He tossed the FBI brick to the side. The only things coming out of the Phoebe frequencies now were profanities. His pencil squeaked some more, and he built a static picket line along the south side of the mall, 3 cars on 7th, 14th, and 17th streets, leaving the tunnels at 9th and 12th unguarded. At dusk, Cleo observed Golob's black BMW ooze up 14th Street. Softly, she called him through, just direction and speed. She pulled into the traffic and followed him, as only a grandmother could, tenderly and with great concern. The two other Orion cars converged on Golov using parallel tracks along 18th and Pennsylvania. Mel and Sock relinquished the eye to Johnny near McPherson Square, where he saw Golov enter a parking garage. The team prepared to cover the Russian on foot, and it was here they really excelled. They had not used the ABC formation in a decade. Instead, they swirled around the rabbit, dipped him in chocolate. They moved ahead, they walked back through, they crossed in front, they looped far ahead. If Golov happened to glance in an Orion's direction, he or she did not flinch or turn away or window shop. Rheumy eyes met him for an instant, then proceeded with absent-minded sweetness, blue hair under improbable berets, rakish fisherman caps, packages, purses, librarian eyeglasses, and a briar pipe. Golov, tall and patrician and at home on the streets of Paris or London, didn't register a thing. They were too good, too natural, too fluid. They were invisible among the casuals on the street, especially to a senior SVR officer exhausted by the pressure, fed up with the uncompromising burdens of tradecraft, and who was working on a serious case of tunnel vision with each step closer to the Tabard Inn. The Russian was being had by 5 pensioners with liver spots and bad knees. If he could detect someone, he could turn away, buy a newspaper, order a coffee, head home, the meeting aborted. But he didn't see anything. The rain had stopped, and when Golov turned down N Street, trapdoor closed. It was the Tabard Inn, the only possibility on N, forget the Topaz Hotel. Mel and Cleo were already waiting inside the lobby, shoes off, chafing their feet, exclaiming, "My goodness, how they hurt." They watched as Golov got a room key and disappeared up the narrow staircase. Their discipline and a firmly established procedure compelled them to stay in place for a half hour, to observe activity and potentially interesting individuals. They had no law enforcement arrest authority, and loitering longer than that would alert the target. So Sock called Benford, gave him a terse report, and hung up. Then he keyed the radio and clicked them out of there. They hadn't witnessed a meeting, they didn't have squat. They had foxed the SVR resident, but there was no agent, no suspect. Patience and perspective helped them cope with the inconclusive evening, as did late-night hot dogs at the Shake Shack on 18th. A Russian intelligence officer was very likely meeting clandestinely with an unidentified penetration of the U.S. government as the Orions ordered their dogs. Johnny China's ops background manifested itself in sesame slaw and chilies. Orest was a purist and would accept only mustard and kraut. Mel favored onions and ketchup. Cleo, the classical pianist, had hers with lettuce, tomato, bacon, and blue cheese. Socrates had years ago shocked them into uneasy silence by inventing the depth charge, the ingredients for which were available only at the Shake Shack, a disgusting smear of pan-fried potatoes, caramelized onions, anchovies, and fiery Argentine chimichurri sauce. By mutual consent, the Orions had agreed that they would never eat in their vehicles with Sock. Benford was on the phone to the FBI, alternatively screaming and blaspheming, then begging them to deploy a team to cover the Tabard Inn this instant. Several calls were relayed, a shift supervisor was notified, surveillance squad members were activated. In the 2 hours it took for the G's to deploy around the little hotel, Stephanie Boucher had arrived, met with Golov, and departed. It would not have been difficult to follow the senator, certainly not as challenging as it was following Anatoly Golov. It would not have been as challenging as following a flock of Japanese tourists walking along the tidal basin holding pink umbrellas. In fact, it would not have been as challenging as following an elephant through a rice paper factory with a bell on its tail. The measure of her arrogance and sociopathy was that Senator Boucher did not even remotely look for surveillance when on the street, even though she was engaged in the ultimate adventure of treason. She had parked in a loading zone on N Street, the only free space around. She counted on the inviolability conferred by her red and white congressional license plates. When she left the meeting with Golov minus another Pathfinder Corporation disc, she drove straight home. The FBI missed it all. Bedford reviewed the Orion surveillance log the next day while raving at the FBI special agents in the room. Nate, backbenched, sat quietly along the wall. "Forgive me," said Bedford in his reedy professor voice, which Nate recognized as the first of the red swallowtail storm flags of a whole gale. "I alert you to the fact that the SVR Washington resident has gone to ground after a multi-hour SDR, doubtless to meet the U.S. mole classified as a director's case by the center. It takes your organization over 120 minutes from the time of my call to deploy around the Tabard Inn, which is roughly 1.6 miles from the J. Edgar Hoover building. Despite the empirical evidence of contact between the Russian and an American trader, your people did not check the register or speak with hotel staff, much less pound up the stairs and enter Golov's room. Had you entered that room and physically searched the most senior SVR officer in the Northern Hemisphere, you doubtless would have recovered classified information in one form or another provided that very evening by Golov's American agent." The FBI SAs shifted in their seats. Yet the FBI did nothing. In this arguably the biggest espionage case since 2001, you let the traitor walk out of the room unidentified and at large. "Suspect," said Chaz Montgomery. His tie was a Gauguin print of a lounging Polynesian girl. Bedford experienced physical pain when looking at it. "What?" said Bedford, his voice rising. Nate wondered if the exchange would end with one of the FBI SAs actually shooting Bedford to make him stop talking. "I said suspect," said Montgomery. "Whoever is meeting with Golov is a suspect." Bedford looked around the room. "Chaz, would you send me the current curriculum of your basic training course at the academy?" he said. "I expect to discover brightly colored pictures of ponies and flowers." "Fuck you, Bedford," said Montgomery. "You know the rules, and I'm guessing you're at least remotely familiar with the law. We need evidence, incontrovertible evidence, before we move forward to arrest anyone." "And tossing Golov?" asked Bedford. "Ever hear of diplomatic immunity? We don't even know if there was a meeting or what, if anything, was passed. He could have been there to hand out invitations to the Russia Day reception at the embassy." "You're not serious," said Bedford. "You know as well as I that we need to build a solid book before we act. These investigations take time. It could break tomorrow, next week, next year." "You men are Tartars, Mongols, Visigoths, Carthaginians," said Bedford, shaking his head. "What's cancer have to do with it?" asked the young SA whose biceps were visible beneath his starched white shirt. "Carthage, my learned young friend, not carcinogen," said Bedford. "I'd mention the name Hannibal to jog the memory of your lessons at Abilene Agriculture and Mining, but I fear you would recall only the Hannibal of fiction."
"Hannibal the Cannibal," said the SA. "Awesome movie. Bureau kicks ass in it."
"Proctor, shut up," said Montgomery, turning to Bedford. "I don't have to explain it to you. If we do our homework, unsubs in a supermax facility without parole 100%. We make a mistake, and he retires as a seven-figure consultant. You think you can press your legs together a little longer?" "On one condition," said Bedford, acting as if he were offended at the brusque way he had been spoken to. I want a CIA officer to be present when an arrest is made. It's as much an intelligence matter as a criminal one.
I can't agree, said Montgomery. The director won't agree. Besides, anyone involved with the investigation or the surveillance or the arrest is liable to appear in court. Unless you got a guy in mind without cover to preserve, are you willing to burn some case officer's cover for this?
Catching this person probably will cost the agency a valuable asset, said Benford. I want one of our own to be there.
I still don't think the director will approve, but I'll ask, said Montgomery. Who should I tell them you have in mind?
Him, said Benford, pointing at Nate. He's personally invested in the case.
Sitting along the wall, Nate wasn't sure whether he should feel honored or not. His cover was pretty well shredded by now. Besides, he wasn't going to question Benford, especially not in front of a dozen Phoebes.
The special agent with the biceps looked over the back of his chair at Nate, trying to get a clue about what personally invested might mean.
Proctor, do not fucking speak unless someone asks you a direct question, said Montgomery.
Chimichurri sauce.
With a knife or food processor, finely chop a bunch of flat-leaf parsley, an entire head of peeled garlic, and one medium carrot. Add olive oil, white wine vinegar, salt, dried oregano, hot pepper flakes, and black pepper, and chop or pulse into a thick sauce. Best served fresh. Chapter 34. Vanya Igorov was in his office staring through the plate glass, anticipating the imminent collision of operational factors swirling around him. Swan was still producing magnificently, but her lack of discipline made it likely she would burn up eventually. Igorov dared not contemplate losing Swan. The news from Korchnoi, just returned from Italy, was barely adequate. Some contact with Nash, relationship renewed. He had accepted the legend that Dominika was now in the courier service. They established a universal contact plan. Too slow, always too damn slow. The mole was still out there, a threat to Swan, to other cases, to Igorov himself. He ordered Korchnoi to prepare Dominika for another trip, ostensibly as a courier. He needed results. Then his phone rang, the special phone. Unsatisfactory, said the president. I trust you are moving ahead to engineer subsequent contact. No delays. From his KGB days, President Putin knew how important operational momentum could be.
Yes, Mr. President, said Igorov. A second trip by the officer is already scheduled. Results will be forthcoming.
Jesus. Jesus. Now he was blowing smoke up Putin's ass.
Very good, said Putin. Where?
Igorov swallowed. We are determining exactly which overseas location will be most advantageous. I will inform you the instant I decide.
Athens, said Putin.
Mr. President, said Igorov.
Send the officer, your niece, to Athens. Low security threat, we have people inside the police.
Why was he insisting on Greece?
Yes, Mr. President, said Igorov. But Putin had already hung up.
One floor down, Zhuganov looked into a milky eye and at the death's head skull.
Make arrangements for Athens, said the dwarf, and watched the man get up and leave his office.
Zhuganov considered briefly that Dominika could be in danger if she were caught between the Spetsnaz maniac and his target, but that couldn't be helped. Benford had CID researching compartmented defense projects and crunching names. He was waiting for an echo from Vanya's canary trap. The Orions were trying to fox Golov again on the streets of Washington, but he needed something right away. They had discussed it in Rome, and Marble knew what he had to do, despite the risk, and Benford had reluctantly agreed. Korchnoi walked down to the first floor laboratory of Directorate T. Nasaryenko was seated behind his desk, a moonscape riot of papers, boxes, and folders. A long table against the wall was chaos and similarly covered to overflowing.
Nazaryenko looked up at Korchnoi, his Adam's apple bobbing.
Yuri, please excuse the interruption, said Korchnoi, walking up to the desk and shaking Nazaryenko's hand. May I speak with you?
Nazaryenko looked like a sailor suddenly caught on a disintegrating ice floe, contemplating the widening gap between his ship and the ice.
What is it?
Nazaryenko asked. His face was gray and his hair, never overly combed anyway, was straw-like and dull. His glasses were smudged and cloudy.
I need your advice on a communications matter, said Marble, and for the next 15 minutes discussed a backup communication system for a Canadian recruitment target.
Nazaryenko, agitated and with twitching thumbs, distractedly discussed the matter. Korchnoi leaned over Nazaryenko's desk, crowding him, creating blind spots.
What's bugging you, old friend? He asked.
Nothing, said Nazaryenko. It's just that work has been piling up.
Is there anything I can do to help?
It's nothing, said Nazaryenko. Just a lot of work. I'm drinking from a fire hose of data. I need translators, analysts.
His thumbs bent spasmodically as he spoke. Do you know how much information is on a single disk?
He swiveled his chair around to face a four-drawer safe, took out a lidded steel box, and shook it out over his desk. A dozen plastic bags stapled at the top spilled onto his blotter. Inside each bag was a disk inside a gray sleeve. He picked up several disks in shaky hands.
These can hold gigabytes of data. I have all these waiting for processing.
He threw a plastic bag across his desk where it skittered under a pile of dun-colored folders. Korchnoi reached over to pick up the little bag. He peered at the piece of plastic as if he could not imagine so much information could fit into such a small object. He read the Pathfinder logo on the side of the disks.
Why can't they give you more staff?
Nazaryenko put his head in his hands. Korchnoi felt sorry for this pugalo, this scarecrow, with his straw hair and flapping arms.
Yuri, don't panic, he said. You've done too much excellent work for too many years to be treated this way.
As Korchnoi reached across the desk to pat Nazaryenko on the shoulder, he slipped the plastic bag with the disk into the out-of-sight pocket on his suit coat.
Were the disks sequential? Were they logged in? Would Nazaryenko notice one of 24 was missing?
I could send one or two analysts from my department to assist you temporarily, if that would help. God knows we're all short-handed, but your work is critical. Could you use them?
Nazaryenko looked up gloomily.
Your analysts could not work on the sensitive project. It is restricted.
Maybe they can work on other projects to give you some time.
Yuri, don't say no. It's settled, said Korchnoi. I'll send over two of my analysts this afternoon, but Yuri, Korchnoi wagged a finger at him, don't even dream that you'll steal them.
Nazaryenko smiled thinly.
Washington resident Golov's cable reporting the barium variant with shingles was lying on Vanya Igorov's desk. A single page with a diagonal blue line across the text. It was wrinkled from repeated clench-fisted readings. The line KR chief Zhuganov sat in a chair in front of Igorov, delighted beyond measure. Igorov shook his head.
I cannot believe that Nazaryenko is the mole, he said. He can barely carry a conversation in the cafeteria. Can you see him at night meeting with the Americans?
Zhuganov licked his lips.
Shingles.
Golov would not make a mistake with this. You read his report, a direct quote from Swan. The mole is afflicted with shingles. The variant used with Nazaryenko.
He is an absent-minded fool, said Igorov, not really knowing why he was defending the man. He could have mentioned it to others. The word could have gotten back from another source.
Zhuganov didn't really care. All he knew was that he would be crawling into Nazaryenko's head. Now he had a job to do.
Damn it. It's all we have right now, said Igorov. Start immediately on an investigation, every aspect.
Zhuganov nodded, hopped down off the chair, and headed for the door. He tried to remember where he had put his red army tunic, the one with the buttons on the side, the one he liked wearing during interrogations, the greenish-brown material stiff with brown dried blood spots and thick with the stable stench of 100 bowels, looked smarter than a lab coat, though the sleeves were slightly frayed. "One more thing," said Igorov after him. "Check him for Mietka, for tracking compounds. If he's touched an American in the last 2 years, something may show up." Zhuganov nodded, but he had his own opinion of spy dust. He preferred Povanaya. Confession, magnificent, liberating confession. The best way to establish guilt. Zhuganov had a connate sense of how to convince subjects. After the screams and separated tendons and spilled ocular fluid, to agree to confess to whatever they were required to confess to. He still couldn't remember where his army tunic was. They summoned Nasiryanka to counterintelligence for a random security update. One did not need to work in the SVR for long to know that this kind of interview represented quite serious trouble, and it set Nasiryanka into a panic. After the requisite inconclusive interview with the confused and weeping scientist, Zhuganov transferred him straight to the cellars, in this case to Butorkia in central Moscow. He shrugged on his tunic with anticipation. "People are funny," thought Zhuganov, fingering the lightweight truncheon. "They all react differently." With Nasiryanka, it was the soles of his feet and the hollow aluminum baton. Much more of a reaction than the average subject. Zhuganov was able to complete one session with the pop-eyed scientist before an inventory of his laboratory revealed that a swan disk was missing, and the Pietka, the torture, stopped because this was something critical. Zhuganov authorized a course of amibarbital that unpeeled Nasiryanko's memory enough for him to walk them through the recent past, reviewing staff and colleagues and visitors, including the brief visit by General Korchnoi to Nasiryanko's laboratory. Korchnoi. Impossible. Make another sweep of the lab. There had to be an explanation. Where was the disk? Korchnoi heard the rumors about the mole hunt redoubled, about trouble in Directorate T, about sensitive materials gone missing. He spoke to old friends in other departments and listened to the porcelain gossip in the senior officer toilets. Nasiryanka had not been seen in days. Korchnoi knew the searchers and investigators and counter-espionage interrogators would start closing in. He urgently had to send Benford a note, as well as pass the disk he had shoplifted from Nasiryanko's lab to the CIA instantly, via dead drop this evening. That is, if they still let him walk out of headquarters. He wondered if he had played it too close, whether he had enough time for Dominika to make another trip to Athens and blow the whistle on him. Korchnoi walked out of headquarters on his own legs. Not very much longer, he reckoned, and once back in his apartment composed a message. His burst transmission took a fraction of a second. 20 minutes later, Benford read the two lines of the message. Nasiryanka is in the snare. We'll load D.D. Drakon. Dead drop, thought Benford. The old fox must have something important. And Nasiryanko's in trouble. That means one of their 23 names in Washington is Swan. He reached for the phone to call the FBI. The night rain sheeted the street, blowing almost horizontally with the gusts of wind. The platform and stairs of the Molodeznaya metro stop were deserted, a few cars moving, stores closed. Marble flipped up the collar of his raincoat, jammed his hands into the pockets, and started walking slowly up Leninskaya Ulitsa. He had ridden 3 separate trains, taken a long walk along the river, before his instincts had been satisfied. There was nothing moving around him or out on the wings, and he did not sense the presence or pressure of men on the street watching him. Keep walking, steady pace. Final approach and sloshing through the rain, water-like fingers down his back. Night creature, hug the wall, listen for the squeak of shoes behind you. Follow Leninskaya through black woods, then the dog-leg curve of the road and the trees. One light from obstetrics school number 81 flickering through the branches. Quickly now, off the pavement and into the dripping woods. Marble shivered. Shut up, stop moving, watch and listen. Especially listen for the gearbox banging or the brakes squealing or the doors chunking. Just the wind creaking the trees. Time to move. Black water was gurgling through a metal culvert under the roadway, and Marble knelt and took the pouch out of his pocket, stripped the backing off the adhesive, stuck his arm in, and pressed the gray matte package hard against the inner curve of the culvert. Hold for a count of 10, let the epoxy cure, and listen for the splash that doesn't come. Satisfactory. He checked himself again, defending the cache on the way out, and all the way to the barnyard heat of the Korletskoye Metro. There was a sodden pile of clothes on his kitchen floor, and the keyboard shook in his hands, and the stylus was too small, even with reading glasses. Hell, don't they build these things for old eyes? Because no one lives that long, that's why. And the recessed button felt hot as he released the dove into space. Have loaded DD Site Dracon. Marble sat back in his armchair and closed his eyes. Come unload Dracon, retrieve the little black disc, and God preserve the young-limbed CIA boy who will get mud on his suit, or the ponytailed embassy wife, Phonak in her ear, listening for squelch breaks from the radio cars. The station heat wrapped it twice, tight around the corners, and swaddled the box in burlap, and stapled it, and banded it, and jammed it into the Halloween orange K-bag with the lockable zipper, and flew it home, courier direct, because this one was from Marble. And the dove came back with the branch in its mouth. Dracon recovered, and the culvert in the woods vomited its black water but kept its secret nearly forever. Benford sat at a conference table in the basement of FBI headquarters on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. The table was littered with the remains of lunch ordered out from several local restaurants. This was a working lunch, no executive dining room for them now. Benford had ordered a Thai chicken salad called Larb Gai, succulent ground chicken with onions and chilies, basil and lime, so highly seasoned that he was blowing contentedly like a steam boiler while others around the table finished their more conventional Episcopalian lunches of sandwiches or soup. The table was divided evenly between CIA and FBI, mostly senior-level officers from technical and counterintelligence divisions. When the courier from Moscow arrived with Marble's pouch, Benford, even Benford, agreed to let the FBI handle the forensic dissection of the package to ensure proper procedure. "These federal automatons," said Benford earlier to Nathaniel, "have been speaking to me about maintaining the evidentiary chain as regards Marble's package. If he has in fact recovered an actual disc containing top-secret information passed by hand to the Russians from Swan, then according to our feebish colleagues, we must begin thinking about considerations of admissible evidence and securing convictions and such things." Benford had uncharacteristically deferred to them. Benford contemplated a metal evidence tray at the center of the table. The disc, now out of its SVR outer plastic and Pathfinder inner paper sleeve, lay in the bottom of the tray on a sterile towel, its surface lightly coated with gray powder. FBI techs had followed procedure and staggered the tests, an anhydrin swab to raise existing latent prints on the drive, then the spritz of calcium oxide for contrast. Seated around the table, everybody could see the three distinct single prints on the dull surface. What would it be? A Russian lab rat's salami thumbprints? Or the whorls and ridges of an American mole? Benford knew that Marble would not have opened the plastic envelope. He would have been too good, too careful, to touch the actual disc itself. The Phoebes had taken photos and lifts to the laboratory for enhancement. An automated search in the FBI's print archives was already underway. Benford was in his car heading back up the GW Parkway toward headquarters when his car phone rang.
It was the deputy chief of the FBI laboratory services. "You might want to turn around and come back down here," the FBI man told Bedford. "You are freaking not going to believe the hit we just got."
"This better be good," said Bedford, looking for the spout run exit so he could double back.
"Oh, it's good all right," said the FBI scientist.
Benford's Thai Chicken Salad, Larb Guy. Finely hand-chop lean chicken breasts with a large knife or cleaver. Season with lime juice and rice wine and sauté until crumbly and white. Let chicken cool and fold in lemongrass, diced garlic, diced chilies, lemon zest, fish sauce, salt, and pepper. Incorporate well. Add chopped cilantro, basil, mint, and scallions. Toss well. Serve in lettuce cups with rice.
Chapter 35. The DNA Fingerprint Act of 2005 was in that year drafted, submitted to, and discussed in the Senate Judiciary Committee of Congress, but for a variety of political reasons unrelated to national security, was deferred twice and taken off the docket. The bill intended to establish a national fingerprint and DNA archive for background checks, criminal and immigration registration, and identification for federal employees in sensitive jobs. Caucus leadership in the Senate had at the time mildly suggested to freshman Senator Stephanie Boucher that in the interest of bipartisan comedy, she join a mixed group of Democrats and Republicans in support of the bill. Even though she personally opposed the notion of a national archive of identity information as an obscene invasion of privacy, Senator Boucher privately assessed that her public support of the bill would strengthen her national security credentials and play well to the many high-tech aerospace companies in her state. She even participated in a televised bit of dumb crambo. Legislators agreed to be fingerprinted and for DNA samples to be taken in front of reporters. Senator Boucher smiled for the cameras as a technician swabbed the inside of her cheek, prompting one off-camera staff aide to wonder how many separate DNA nucleotides would be found inside that mouth at any given time. The result of this bit of bipartisan theater almost a decade ago, long forgotten by her and unbeknownst to her SVR handlers, was that the fingerprints of Senator Stephanie Boucher resided in the FBI's IAFIS database. When a partial right thumb and smudged index and middle fingerprints were lifted off the classified Pathfinder Satellite Corporation disk taken from the SVR laboratory in Moscow, it took the automated system approximately 10 minutes to identify Boucher's latents from among the more than 25,000 civilian prints stored in the system. Benford and FBI counterintelligence chiefs for the next days huddled in conference rooms on both sides of the Potomac, not so much to argue about primacy in the case or to debate the finer points of a full court investigation of the senator, but to determine how to keep the White House, the National Security Council, the Capitol Police, the U.S. Senate, the California State Legislature, the City Council of Los Angeles, and the California State Raisin Growers Association from leaking details of the investigation to the media. "The last thing we need is for Boucher to panic and to defect to the Russians," said Charles Chaz Montgomery, chief of the Bureau's National Security Division. "Nonsense," said Benford, gathering up maps after a long session to discuss surveillance. "Sending Boucher permanently to Moscow would be better than detonating a neutron bomb in Red Square." The CIA and FBI formulated their tactical plan for blanket coverage on the street and for telephone, mail, and trash covers. Boucher didn't know it, but she had become the flaxen-haired milkmaid walking alone on the gray moor as the first howls of the hounds came up out of the fog from the boggy ravines over the rocky ledges. It was already too late to run. The California house owned by Senator Boucher was a low-slung, slate-roofed, prairie-style, five-bedroom hilltop retreat on Mandeville Canyon Road in Brentwood, with a view of the Pacific on one side and the waffle iron lights of Los Angeles on the other. A black-bottomed pool and sprawling paved deck in the center of the U-shaped house fizzed under the hazy sunlight. The sliding glass doors of the bedroom wing were open and music drifted out, Languorous, careening, enticing, K.D. Lang and Miss Chatelaine. Stephanie Boucher lay on the sheets of an immense bed with an imposing black ash headboard of a certain Scandinavian severity. The slash of black contrasted with a bedroom done in beiges and creams. The senator was naked. A band pulled her hair back tightly on her head. Next to her lay a man half Boucher's age. In his mid-twenties, he played in one of those outfield positions, either for the Dodgers or the Angels. Stephanie couldn't remember which. He was asleep, naked, an ebony baby grand glistening with morning sweat, the rippling muscles of his back like the stones in a creek bed. He lay on his stomach, feet crossed at the ankles. Stephanie slowly moved to the edge of the bed, trying not to wake what's-his-name. It was less a matter of being considerate than it was of not wanting to stir him to additional exertions. Last night had been enough, hours of it, some of it significantly painful. Legs weren't designed to be bent that far. Certain body parts were meant to be used in only one direction. But it was the only way to fly, she thought as she slid off her side of the bed, her back and thighs and belly itchy. She looked into the bathroom mirror and combed her hair and saw her mother's face in the little bedroom of the little house in Hermosa, swollen and slack, and sitting up in bed sharing a cigarette with a man, sometimes old and fat, sometimes young and skinny, tattoos and mustaches and buzz cuts and ponytails, and Stephanie would close the door and look at the wall clock in the kitchen and wish just once her timid, frightened father would come home from work early. After the funeral and the trial, Stephanie looked into another mirror and told herself that no one was going to help her if she didn't help herself, which was why she had called her father to come home that final afternoon. Senator Boucher reclined on a padded steamer chair by the side of the pool and picked at a shrimp salad laced with cumin and dill. She had thrown on a white cotton cover-up to spare her assistant the discomfort of seeing her topless as they worked. This latest staff aide, a jumpy, size 14 nail-biter named Missy, was sitting at a table covered with papers. Missy was the senator's third personal assistant in the last 12 months. The bleached bones of previous staffers on Team Boucher littered the landscape from Washington to Los Angeles. Missy read from a folder reviewing the senator's upcoming California schedule. There would be two speaking events in San Diego and Sacramento, a visit to Pathfinder Satellite in Los Angeles for a classified briefing, and a fundraising dinner in San Francisco. She had to return to Washington no later than Tuesday of next week, in time for the appropriations vote on supplementals for the Pentagon. Boucher told Missy to remind her also to order a top-to-bottom review of the CIA's classified budget. She would ram unpleasant things up the CIA's fanny in the next few months. That mental image prompted Boucher to look across the pool at the open bedroom doors. Her shortstop was still asleep, thank God. She would get her driver to take him to the ballpark or Malibu or... Movement. Quite a lot of it. The housekeeper escorted four men onto the pool area from the main wing of the house. Three wore suits and white shirts with muted ties, laced shoes, and aviator shades. One carried a briefcase. The fourth man was Nate, dark-haired and thin. He wore a blazer over a cotton shirt, jeans, and loafers. Boucher watched them come across the deck. Her brain, overheated and mazy, registered a whiff of danger. Whoever these bureaucrats were, she would break some balls, act pissed at this interruption. They didn't give her a chance to build up a head of steam. "Senator Stephanie Boucher," said the oldest of the three suits. "I'm Special Agent Charles Montgomery from the National Security Division of the FBI." He opened a black wallet to display official identification. His two colleagues did the same, but young Tab Hunter behind them didn't make a move. "You're under arrest for espionage as an agent of a foreign power in violation of USC Title 18, Section 794A and 794C of the Espionage Act of 1917. Boucher looked up at the men, squinting in the sunlight. She purposely had not gathered her cover-up around her, and it hung loosely on her shoulders,
slightly revealing the curve of her small breasts.
"What are you talking about?" she asked. "Are you crazy? Do you think you can barge into my house without making an appointment?"
Missy sat silent at the table, looking back and forth at the men and her boss.
"Senator, I'm going to have to ask you to stand up," said the FBI agent. "I need you to come inside the house and get dressed."
He began reciting a Miranda warning as he gently took Boucher by the arm to lift her out of the recliner.
"Take your hands off me," said Boucher. "I'm a U.S. Senator. You fuckers just bit off more than you can chew."
She turned to the plump Missy still sitting motionless at the table. Missy was mentally reviewing how the day had begun, with a half hour of syncopated grunts and wailing from the bedroom, and how it was progressing with the FBI arresting her boss. She wondered how it would end.
"Missy, get on the phone. I want you to make 3 calls right away," said Boucher.
Montgomery was courteously helping the senator get to her feet.
"Call the fucking attorney general this minute. I don't care where he is or what he's doing. I want him on the phone. Second, call the chairman of the SSCI. Same drill. I want him on the line in 5 minutes. Then call my lawyer and tell him to get over here instantly."
Boucher turned to the FBI men standing in a semicircle around her. "Your boss at Justice will impale you on a spit, and my lawyer will roast you over an open flame." Missy hurriedly gathered her papers, but an FBI agent gently said, "I'm going to have to take these papers, miss. Sorry." Missy looked once at the FBI agent, and then at her boss, and rushed inside the house. The FBI agents walked Boucher across the deck toward the main wing of the house. In the living room, Boucher pulled brusquely away from the restraining hand on her arm.
"I told you dickheads to take your hands off me," she said. "This is outrageous. You have no right accusing me. Where's your evidence? Where's the proof?"
She walked stiffly to the couch and sat down. There was a hairline crack in her unassailable confidence and arrogance now. She wanted to buy some time, give her lawyer time to get here. Golov's constant yammering about security, maybe she should have paid more attention. Still, the FBI didn't know squat. Golov was a pro. No way they could prove a thing. She did not contemplate the possibility that it was she, Boucher, who may have compromised everything.
"I'm waiting for my attorney," she said, crossing her arms across her chest.
"Senator, we have properly identified ourselves as federal officers. We have read you your rights. Do you understand these rights?" Boucher stared at him, refusing to answer. "If you do not understand these rights, I will repeat them. If you do so, indicate that you understand them. And keeping these rights in mind, do you wish to speak to us now?" Boucher figured that any temporizing and delay would be in her interest. The calls to Washington and to her lawyer would soon result in a flurry of action that would string this out for months or years. Boucher told herself that if they had not caught her red-handed, they couldn't prove shit. Allegations, flawed conclusions, unsubstantiated associations. She knew all about this kind of trench warfare. She could brawl with the best of them. She looked up at the FBI agents and said, "I'm not answering any of your questions." Special Agent Montgomery snapped his fingers and reached around for the briefcase. He took out a folder and laid it on the coffee table in front of Boucher. She opened the file and saw a timeline of classified briefings that she had attended at Pathfinder Satellite Corporation, and records of personal bank accounts reflecting a dozen unexplained cash deposits from unknown sources, each for exactly $9,500, totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars. She remembered demanding mad money payments and how Golov tried to dissuade her. The Capitol Hill instincts in her head told her this was still circumstantial. A good lawyer could create doubts, obfuscate, keep the ball rolling. Boucher looked up at Montgomery, defiant. "Just a lot of paper. Doesn't mean squat."
"Senator, please take a look at the last document in the file."
Boucher flipped over the penultimate page at the bottom of the file. A brilliantly clear black-and-white photograph of a disc with the Pathfinder logo on it, white and smudged with powder.
"We acquired this disc with your latent prints on it from Moscow," said Montgomery.
Boucher did not speak.
The living room was quiet. Muted music came from the bedroom wing, Yanni's Out of Silence album with John Tesh on keyboards, Missy's favorite. Montgomery cleared his throat and slid a one-page document single-spaced across the table at Boucher. It had an embossed FBI logo at the top. "What's this?" "If you have understood the rights as I have explained them to you, this is a